People really like to feel comfortable. They don't like to be out of their comfort zone. But sometimes you have to learn to be comfortable being uncomfortable.
Today, I'm joined by Leah Goldstein. By age 17, Leah Goldstein was the world kickboxing champion. Shortly after, she enlisted in the Israeli military and became one of the few female instructors of the elite commando division, specializing in Krav Maga. Leah then transitioned into a special forces unit combating terrorism and violent crime. The extreme lifestyle of the secret police eventually took its toll, and she found her salvation on a bicycle. She convinced Israel to release her as she pursued a brilliant career as a professional cyclist in Europe and North America, and eventually to the longest single race in the world, Race Across America. From crashes to podiums and fear to triumph, Leah's story gives us a glimpse of what's truly possible from a life without limits. You're listening to Success in Mind, the show for high-performing leaders, changemakers, and entrepreneurs ready to take your life and business to the next level. If you're ready for whole-life success, keep listening. Have you ever dreamed about launching your own podcast, but you don't know where to start? Well, I have great news for you. I have created the Podcast Launch Strategy Checklist just for you. It is a free, comprehensive guide to take you from the beginning of your show's concept through to launch and then promotion of your podcast. So why wait? Don't let the uncertainty hold you back any longer. Grab your free Podcast Launch Strategy Checklist today by visiting terryholland.ca/podlaunchchecklist. It's in the show notes. It's time to turn your passion into a powerful podcast that the world can't wait to hear. Hi, Leah. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
I have to say, I am so fascinated by your life. I first was introduced to your story, and I think it was 2019. I heard you speak. Yeah. And then I read your book, and I've been following you ever since. And I just think you have such an extraordinary story. So, world champion kickboxer, Israeli undercover police officer, ultra endurance cyclist. Most people would be extraordinary to accomplish one of those in their lifetime. How have you managed to accomplish all of them?
I mean, honestly, it was just kind of by accident, right? I was introduced to like the whole martial arts thing because of being bullied in school. I was introduced to the bike from lieutenant in the Israeli army who did duathlons, triathlons. I was introduced to ultra endurance cycling as a pro cycling, realizing that I'm better at the longer races. So things kind of just happened as you try new things as life goes on and you go, wow, you really like it. And I just had a passion for these things that I've done and I just kind of took it to the limits with it.
That's amazing. Can we start with your childhood? Because about the bullying story.
Oh, sure.
Are you sure that's how you got through that and how you found your way into martial arts?
Well, I mean, I was bullied in elementary school. Me and my best friend, Matthew, like every lunch hour between like 12 and 12:45, we were chased by a group of 8 boys. And I called it the Jason Gang, right? And back in my generation, we were often told not to tattletale, right? You got to figure things out for yourself. I didn't want to tell my parents because they were struggling. We had just come to Canada and they didn't know English. So life was not so easy. So I got 1 hour of television back then. Then I had to go outside and play till it got dark, right? So I was looking for my favorite show. And at that time, it was a show called Gilligan's Island, right?
Oh,
so I was flipping through the channels. I see this Asian man, like small Asian man fighting like 5, 10, 15 people. And I get really excited. And it was Bruce Lee. And he was doing Kung Fu. And I thought, wow, he fights off 30 people. I only have to fight off 8. So that's when I begged my mother for lessons. I said, I got to learn whatever this guy is doing. So that's how she enrolled me in the sport of Taekwondo, which is a Korean form of self-defense.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And from that point on, like, did you know right away that this was, like, when you first started Taekwondo, did you know there's something in this for you? Or what was your journey from there?
Well, I fell in love with it. I mean, it was just something that came really natural to me. And I think, too, because my dad was a champion in the sport of boxing. So we always watched boxing on television and he would teach me the way they stand, the way they move, the way they punch. So you mix the two together, you get a little bit of a kickboxer, right? So I excelled in Taekwondo and I loved the sport. It just came natural to me. By the time I was 12 years old, I was a junior national champion. And then from there, it's kind of when I transitioned into kickboxing. A kickboxing coach discovered me and he goes, "This sport is more suited for you."
Wow. Wow. So amazing. And then Who would you say have been your biggest influences in shaping who you are today?
I mean, I think I got a lot of positivity for sure from my parents. Like, my dad really installed independence in my sister and I, right? Not to be afraid to do the things that you love and not let anyone tell you what you can or can't do when you have a passion for something. And my mom, of course, always being supportive. Like, she never said no to my sister and I with anything that we wanted to do. So I think having a strong parents with strong influences and encouragement really helped us do the things that we wanted to do in life. So it was a huge bonus.
Yeah, absolutely. And what did they think about you getting into fighting and getting into kickboxing?
Well, my dad wasn't thrilled, I'll tell you that much. He wasn't thrilled because he was a boxer. So he knows that it's a tough sport, right? You know, but I think when he saw my passion for it, how much I loved it, and like, I was really adamant about always going to my Taekwondo lessons, and I would train in the morning, I would train after school, I would train in the evening. So then he started to see how serious I was, and he kind of came on board with helping me kind of train, getting boxing coaches and building me a gym in the back, right? So it was kind of rough waters in the beginning, but it became smoother as the career progressed.
Great. And what was that journey like for you in terms of becoming a world champion? What did you have to do in order to get to that level?
Well, I mean, it's funny because my kickboxing coach, when he said to me, if you want to do this sport, then he gave me conditions. Remember, I'm a 13-year-old teenager, right? He goes, no smoking, yeah. No drinking, no drugs, no friends, no swear, train 7 weeks, train twice a day, right? When you're a kid, you have parties and friends and good times. But I knew at that age, in order to be the best in the world, I had a lot of sacrifices. I didn't train 7 days a week twice a day. I trained 7 days a week three times a day. And I realized that you really have to laser in, giving yourself 110%. And at the age of 17 years old, as Ellen Chang, my coach, predicted, I was the undefeated champion of the world.
Amazing. And what an incredible work ethic to have at such a young age. Like, I know many adults who struggle with those kinds of sacrifices and doing what they need to do to get to where they want. And so to have that at such a young age is so incredible.
Well, I mean, when you're going, like, I think any athlete reaching for a gold medal or world championship or whatever, they're just completely consumed with it, right? And you'll do whatever it takes to get there. And so for me, I was my passion and my goal, and I was willing to do whatever it took to become the best kickboxer in the world.
Oh. At any point during that, did you ever feel like you were missing out, or did you ever regret your choices, or did you just know this is what you wanted?
No, I think because, like, good times, friends, whatever, they're always going to be around, but unique and special opportunities won't. And I knew that, right? I mean, it's better to do those things anyways when you're an adult, because your parents won't tell you what to do or think to help.
For sure.
To be honest with you, I wasn't a big, huge social butterfly. I didn't like to go to parties. I didn't have a heck of a lot of friends. I usually had one good friend or two friends. I was more kind of introvert, a little bit quiet, shy. So for me, this was a good thing. And I said, I was just consumed with this. I was obsessed with it. And so that was my life at that time.
And then how did you go from, so you were world kickboxing champion and then into the Israeli undercover police service? How did you get there?
Well, that's way back. You have to back up a little bit. I knew what I wanted to do when I was 7 years old, right? But I never told anyone. I knew that when I'd graduate from high school, I'd go back to Israel and I joined the IDF, which is the Israel Defense Force, and hoping from there I would transition into some security agency, which I did. I worked for the Bilush. So that's kind of what was my goal from way back when. And you'd think too, as a child, like, you have these big dreams that dream would kind of diminish, but it just got stronger as I got older. So after I won the world championships, I actually went back to Israel.
Wow. And what was that part of your life like for you?
It was intense, to say the least.
Yeah. Well,
I mean,
yeah.
I was put in a special unit in the military because they kind of scope you out, kind of what you're good at, what you're not. And there was 300 of us recruits, and then they kind of put you through a series of mental and physical exercises, and we were cut down to like 50. And then cut down to 10. And then I was cut down to 2. And I was one of the 2 that was placed in a base called Base 8, the Bad Shmona. And it's a base where I trained elite units. And I was the first female instructor to train the commando. And my unit was called the Unit of Krav Maga, which you might heard. I mean, maybe many North Americans have heard that term, Krav Maga.
Yeah, no.
It's a it's a Hebrew term. Like Krav means fight and Maga means hand, so lethal hand combat. And that form of self-defense actually designed for soldiers. Let's say if their ammunition jams, how to use a rock, a stick, a stone in a very lethal way. So that's kind of the basis of that kind of self-defense.
Wow. And then from there, you ended up in endurance cycling. How did you get to that point? I guess it's amazing. You've had all these different...
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the military, I always had to be very fit. So one of the lieutenants there saw that when I wasn't training troops, I was training myself. And he also noticed that I also commuted to the base with my bike, because with a military salary, I mean, I had a car, but I had no money to buy gas. So I used my bike, right? So he asked me if I wanted to go for a ride. And this lieutenant was also Israel's national champion in the sport of triathlon. So we went on this ride. I didn't really want to go, but I didn't want to be rude and say no. So we went on this ride, and that's basically where I was born. I fell in love with the sport. He started coaching me. And at that time, I mean, it wasn't in my head that this is what I wanted to do, that this was really what my calling was, but I continued racing duathlons because there was no pro women's racing in the Middle East at that time. Okay. And I was winning almost everything, beating men. And it wasn't so much the running part, it was the cycling part. That's where the obsession was, right?
Right.
Well, yeah, that kind of just stuck with me until I was like 30 after the Belouche, after working for Spotting Agency, that I came back to North America.
Wow. You know, in reading your book, like one of the things that stood out to me so much was that you keep going way beyond the point that most people would quit. And what is it that keeps you going and keeps that drive?
I mean, I think I have a goal in mind, right? I think when we want to do something, you have to think what your finish line is, kind of, right? Like where you want to get to and kind of the sacrifices that it's going to take for you to get to that point, right? And I knew that when I put my mind to it, I'm going to get there no matter how long it takes, right? Like, for example, I also kind of preach this, that even if you find a passion that you're not necessarily gifted in, right? Because there's a gift we all have. It's called the gift of work. Because in pro racing, I wasn't gifted in the sport. I left the Middle East to go into professional racing thinking that I'm going to explode because I was so good back in the Middle East. That was a big fish in a small pond. I come to North America and I'm a shrimp in an ocean. And I'd go into these races coming in so last that I wouldn't even know where the finish line was, because everybody would be finished and they'd leave, right? I mean, that's how I started my career. Like when you talk about rock bottom, right? But I had such a determination and a passion that failure for me wasn't an option. And it took me 8 years to reach that point of racing that I wanted to reach, becoming one of the best cyclists in the world. So sometimes it's going to be sacrifice. And for me, it was 8 years. Coming at 30 years old, finally at the age of 38, winning these national championships, winning these huge stage races, racing up, getting offers for big teams. But it took that long to get to that point.
And did you always know that if you kept going at it, you would get there? Or did you ever have any doubts about that?
I mean, you're going to have your doubts for sure, right? I mean, it's a roller coaster ride but every time you get knocked down, you got to get back up, right? Because Every time you get back up, it's harder to knock you down. And I think, too, it's a lot of the mental part of it as well, right? Like for me, it was also kind of not really putting in the work. I knew that I had to work twice as hard as my competitors, right? And also believing that I could do it. Because a lot of people were saying, you know what, when I was like 35, saying, you might want to think about doing something else before you end up living in a cardboard box because
right.
I hate resting, right? You know what I'm saying? But I just made up my mind saying, no, this is going to happen. And I think the trigger point for me was when I heard somebody kind of criticize, they insulted kind of my ability as a cyclist, and it was humiliating. I was completely like a director had said that I couldn't climb worth, excuse my language, couldn't climb worth shit, right? And that just stuck with me. And then I just thought, you know what? I'm going to show them, right? And the following year, I basically moved from Vancouver to Vernon. It's more hilly here. I hired a climbing coach. I came back about 10 pounds lighter and I started climbing those mountains like never before, setting new records. And then all of a sudden at 38, I'm getting all these contracts, right?
Yeah.
So it was a tough, but I like to use that example too, because with other things I did, it kind of came more natural to me, right? And I succeeded, not that I didn't work hard, but this was a real eye opener saying, you know what? Wow, you really are good at this, but it's a good lesson too. And message for other people that you don't have to have a gift in anything you choose to do in order to excel.
I love that. I love that. We can work at it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Definitely. So why ultra endurance cycling, because I was reading up on some of it. I'm like, this sounds crazy. Why?
Because it is crazy. I mean, as a pro racer, I raced with the national team for about 6 years. And we do big races, like the Tour de France. Many of your viewers will understand that race. There is a woman's version of it. It's called Le Grand Bouquet. It's the same kind of idea, 17 stages. And with these bigger races, I noticed too that I excelled in bigger, in large, longer races. I got better as the race progressed rather than getting tired. I recovered really well. And on top of that, in the military, we had a lot of exercises being really sleep deprived, right?
We'd sleep,
you know, 30 minutes a night, sometimes not anything for 2 days. And then they'd make us do these grueling. So you mix those together and you get a really good ultra endurance racer. And also I have the ability to push myself beyond my limits. So the combination of those three makes me a pretty good ultra endurance racer, right?
I would bet. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the sleep deprivation is the biggest one, right? Because if you can't, if you're this person that really needs your 8 hours, then it's not going to be for you. You're going to have a real hard time with the sport.
Yeah, that would be me. There's no way. I'm not sacrificing for anything. Can you give us a little bit of insight into what the training for something like that is like? Like what
for racing across America?
The
mother of all races. It's insane. I mean, for one, it's a 1 year process with the logistics, because I also have a crew with me. So I have a crew of 9 people. So I have a doctor, a massage therapist, a mechanic, a navigator. And I have 2 people always following me. And then the rest are okay. They're doing 12-hour rotations, right? And I have a earpiece. I'm connected to the people in the back. They're telling them, giving me kind of navigation stuff. They give me a toothbrush to brush my teeth, food, whatnot.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's hard because when the race starts, you go the first 40 hours, you're not getting off the bike. And then you'll start your sleep cycle. Because remember, it's a 3,000 mile, which is about 5,000 kgs under, nonstop race. And you only got 12 days to do it. So you have to be really systematic of how much time you're going to spend off the bike. So most of your time is going to be on the bike. And then your sleep cycles are going to start kind of in day 2. And it'll be anywhere between 3 hours tops to 90 minutes to nothing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's absolutely incredible. I can't even imagine. I'm good with 30 minutes on my Peloton and I'm happy with that. I'm good with that.
I mean, most people are too. But it's funny, even, and the thing that you have to navigate to as a rider is the hallucinations. Because when your brain gets really tired and things get kind of wonky, right? Like those big boulders you see them crossing the mountain passes, they're actually moving. They become monsters. The children crossing signs, the kids are actually crossing. At one time, I hallucinated that a black leopard was leaping towards me. So I veered over to the other side of the road. So, you know, it's really kind of a fine line when the crew has to tell you, you know what, we have to pull you over. You need to sleep for 8 or 10 minutes or whatever, which when you do take those kind of cat naps or power naps, when you come out of that, you feel like you just slept 12 hours, right? So, it's kind of, like I said, there's a lot of logistics in regards to this type of race. And your crew is your brains, right? Like they're it's like they have the remote control and they control everything that you do, because a lot of times at 3 o'clock in the morning, you'll be riding your bike going, what am I doing on this bike? You don't even know what you're doing, right?
Yeah.
So they kind of have to monitor all that stuff. And so it becomes quite, like I said, it like a logistical nightmare sometimes, right?
I bet. How do you mentally train yourself for a race like that?
Well, I mean, a lot of it's to do with the training that I do prior to the race, right? I try to replicate as much as I can the stuff that I'm going to go through. Like I'll do a lot of times 24-hour rides, and it's hard when you're not in that race environment. And living in Canada, I have to sometimes hit the trainer, which is an indoor device that you put your bike on. It's like a Peloton kind of bike. We use our own bike, right? Just so your audience knows what I'm talking about. So I'll have to sit on that sometimes for 12 to 15 hours. And I'm just staring at a wall because I do not listen to music. I do not listen to the radio or whatever. Don't watch television. I don't know nothing. I just focus on what I'm doing. And sometimes it's just staring at a blank wall. So you kind of get into this autopilot mode and just sit and stay there. And it can be really difficult, right? So I purposely try to make the training almost harder than what the race is going to feel like.
Wow, that's absolutely amazing. It sounds like it's very, very disciplined. Like you have a lot of discipline going into it.
Yeah, it's very disciplined. Like I said, I mean, I think the percentage of first-time RAM finishes, I think, is like 10% or 12%, because
wow.
I don't think people realize the difficulty, because you have to also qualify for this race. You can't just say, oh, I'm going to go and do RAM, because for one, it's going to cost you anywhere between $25,000 to $50,000, right?
Right.
Unless you're fully sponsored. Like, I'm fortunate to have some really good sponsors that kind of just kind of piggybacked from my pro racing into ultra endurance racing. But don't forget, you're got nine crew that you got to feed, house, transportation, the entry fee itself, and then the gas, the RV, the two follow cars. So you add all that up, that's that you take a mortgage on, you know, on your house.
Yeah.
So you don't want to spend all that money and then go into this race and then, well, you're finished in day two or day three. And don't forget too, like there, you got to think about Mother Nature. I mean, in 2021, right. when I won the overall, it was 55 Celsius going through the desert. And that heat, I don't remember the heat dome in 2021, and it followed us right across the country. Like even in Kansas, I had burned right through my jersey when I went to change whatever clothes. I had welts on my back. And one of my crew members said, what, did you ride shirtless? I go, no. You know what I mean? It was just blistered. It's crazy. So the elements, and then in 2011, it was rain and wind and hail the size of like little golf balls. I remember getting bruised on the side of my face, right? So, I mean, it's just so many things that can happen. And then the saddle sores on top of it, it's the sores you can have and seating. Oh my God, it's just so much fun.
That's exactly what I'm thinking. Yeah, it just sounds so fun. No wonder you do this.
Wow, it's crazy. And then you hate it, but then when you finish, you go, never do it again. And then 2 months later, you sign up again.
My biggest concern is, how do you eat while you're going through that? Like when
you're just eating on the bike. And for me, I'm vegan, so my food is quite limited. But I like to keep my diet as liquid as possible, just so the stomach doesn't have to digest. So a lot of fruits, fresh fruit, watermelon, apples, grapes, bananas, a lot of smoothies are really good. I'm sponsored by Hammer, so something called Perpetuum, which is it's a soy kind of blend of protein and carbohydrates. So it's really an experiment too, because that's also training. You have to train your guts kind of to be able to take this, right? Because it's not easy when it's 50 degrees outside or 110 Fahrenheit or whatever it may be, and you have to eat, but you can't, right? So you have to be strategic on liquid diet or liquid food or something, because you got to think about how many calories you're actually burning. Like I'm 25 pounds lighter when I hit the other side of the country.
I bet.
Yeah. So it's crazy. Yeah. It's a good weight loss program, but I don't recommend it.
Agreed.
I mean, you can eat whatever you want when you get to the other side, but suffer for 10 days or 12 days to get there.
For sure. Yeah. When you do finish the race, like how do you celebrate after? What do you do afterwards?
There's a big banquet after, right? The race, they have a big banquet after, and everyone comes and they celebrate, and it's just, but you're so sleep deprived and so tired that it doesn't really kick in till a couple of weeks after, right? Because you're also not sleeping properly, because you've just, for the last 10 days, you've barely slept, like maybe in a 24-hour period, maybe 90 minutes, like I said, to tops 3 hours, right? And in my case, a lot of times for the second half of the race, we'll cut my sleep to like 30 minutes, right? And take a couple of cat naps, right? So, but of course, I mean, it's a high, it's a natural high, right? You've just done something incredibly crazy, right? You know, that most people couldn't do. So it's definitely, there's something about this, in almost like an addiction, right? That you want to come back for more, right? That's why this year I've actually signed up for something even more challenging called Transamerica, which is, it's a 4,200 mile race, 7,000 kilometers, but it's unsupported. So I can't have any help. Yeah. So it's a different type of training, different kind of logistics, right? Different types of bugs. So I actually hired a coach to help me out with this, right? Greg from Trimax Coaching, because he specializes in this kind of thing. This is the first for me. And I remember the organizer of another bikepacking kind of race invited me to one of his races. And I said, I would never do that in a million years. I can't imagine without a crew, having to do everything by myself, right? So you have to think about it. I mean, I have to be responsible for my hotel, my mechanics, my sleep, my food. Everything is on the rider, right? So it's I'm excited, but it's scary at the same time.
Yeah. I'm glad you do find it scary. it's real,
right? Because you're nervous, kind of scary, right? But I think it's good to do new challenges. Like, I've done RAM 4 times, and I just think to do something a little bit different, a little bit harder. Yeah, it's see how tough I really am.
Yeah. And how, like, when you do have that nervousness, that fear coming up, what are some things that you do to overcome it? How do you deal with it?
Well, I mean, like, for this, again, I'm not experienced with self-supported races. So I'm going to do a practice race in 3 weeks. I'm going to go out and just do like a 600 kilometer loop. And then 3 weeks later, I'll do a 1200 kilometer loop just to kind of test the bike and how fast I can ride. And like right now, I'm actually training with weight. So I'm wearing a 15 pound, like it's a weighted vest, and I have my bike fully loaded to get the feeling, because it's a lot different when you're carrying an extra 40 pounds, right?
Right.
I've been training like that. I mean, So just kind of get the feel of what it's like to be out there. And also, say you're stuck. I mean, I might have to sleep under a tree in my bivy bag, which is just like an emergency knapsack. It's one little knapsack you can fit in the palm of your hand, right? It's like those like blankets you get after a marathon. They're kind of silver.
Oh, yeah.
It's the same idea, but it's just like it's like a bag. So it's just things like that. But I'm speaking with a lot of racers who've done the race and two of the guys who actually won it. So I actually have a meeting tonight with one of them, and I have a list of questions. And so, yeah. So we'll see what happens.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. Do you have any suggestions for people listening to this for how they can improve their own mental toughness? Because I think if we could all have like 1% of your mental strength, we would skyrocket. So any suggestions for how we can develop that?
I mean, I think people really like to feel comfortable. Like, they don't like to be out of their comfort zone, kind of, right? But sometimes you have to learn to be comfortable being uncomfortable, right? And trying new things. See, the biggest impact, I think, was my grandmother, right? Like, for one, life is really short. She had a really bad cancer, really quick progressive cancer. And her last words to me while she was sitting on her deathbed is, "You never want to say the words I wish or what if." Right. And that really stuck with me, because there's so many things she still wanted to do. She was fairly young, like in her early 70s when she passed. Right. Yeah. So I think we have to think about that life goes by so quickly. You know what I mean? And so what if we fail? That's failure is part of success. Right. It's how we learn. That's how we progress. And if you listen to a lot of people who are successful, listen to their backstory. Like, it doesn't matter that I won Race Across America, or I did this, or somebody, whatever. It's what it took to get there. You know what I mean? Like, hitting rock bottom, coming out of that again, like even the crash I had in 2006 where I landed on my face at 80 kilometers an hour, doctors telling me that I'd never walk, definitely never race again, let alone walk, right? So I think is not being afraid and trying those things, because you really like discover things about yourself that you've never known, right? You can't sit there and wait for things to happen. You have to make it yourself, right? And I think once you take that first step, that second step will get easier. That third step will get even easier. You just got to keep moving forward.
Yeah. So speaking of your crash in 2006, when I was reading about it, how did you get through that time? Because a lot of people, I think, would give up there. Like, they would listen to the doctors and go, okay, this is the end for me. How did you know to keep going? And what was going on inside of you?
Well, for one, I mean, at that point, that was after I kind of reached that, was in my 38 when I was getting all these contracts, right? I went to a race and I ended up, somebody kind of leaned into me at 80 kilometers an hour, crashed on my face, and I ended up in the trauma unit in Bend, Oregon. And I remember sitting there when I woke up and doctors saying, well, this is the only thing they said that I might be able to do is swim, which I don't even like swimming. So then I said to myself, I work too damn hard to take that diagnosis, right? And I said to myself, I don't care how long it takes, the pain I'm going to go through, I'm going to get back on that bike, I'm going to race again, I'm going to come back even stronger than I did before all this craziness happened. And I didn't procrastinate. As soon as I made that kind of declaration, that's what I was going to do, I started my recovery right there and then. And the only thing I could do at that time, honestly, was contract my abs. That was it. But every day I did something today that I couldn't do the day before. And being in that positive mode, as hokey pokey as this may sound, I could feel my body starting to bind. And I just worked my butt off. I seriously did. And it wasn't so much the physical part. I knew I could cut back on. It was more the mental part of the flashbacks of the crash, right? Because in pro racing, it's riding really close together. If I'm doing this, I'm kind of touching the person beside me. So it was a lot of work, a lot of mental work too with my coach, but I did. And in less than a year, I was back on the bike and ready to rock and roll.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. What do you do to relax? Do you relax?
I have two wonderful dogs. I have a French bulldog and another bully mix. And I live in Vernon. So we're like trail central here, right? So I like to, every morning I take them, we go for about an hour and a half to 2 hours, just go to nature. And then the evening time I go with them too. I love to spend time really close with my family. Like my mom's my best friend, right? So they're in Vancouver. So I'll go there quite often. And I think too, the thing is it's important to ground yourself, right? I also like to turn my phone off. I don't, you know what I mean? Like, even when I train or whatever, I turn the damn thing off because beep, 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 you're too tempted, right? Or when I'm walking or something, I'm not that important. People can wait, right? My thing too is just learning to be by yourself with yourself without any stimulation. I think it really grounds you, right? And kind of recharges you. So for me, that's really important.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's something that I'm definitely appreciating more and more is turning off the phone and leaving it behind. And it creates so much mental space and clarity when we do that.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's important. I think you need to do that, right? When we're so attached to the phone, it's funny, the other interview that I had, I remember I was in Vancouver with my sister and we were just walking down Granville Street and there was about 15 people at the bus station and every single person was looking at their phone. Like it was just, is this where's the human connection, right? Or even with our young kids, right? It's just a little bit too much screen time for, maybe I'm a little old fashioned, I don't know. But what about the days when we were young, we went out there and we would play and used your mind, you were creative, you had to think of games, right? And I think that needs, just a tiny bit has to come back to this generation, right?
Yeah, I agree. Are you ready to unlock your team's full potential? I'm Terry Holland, and I specialize in igniting passion, boosting morale, and driving results. Whether it's a corporate event, team building workshop, or a keynote address, I'll leave your audience energized and empowered to achieve their goals. You can expect engaging storytelling, actionable strategies, and an unforgettable experience that will propel your team towards success. Let's inspire greatness together. Go to terryholland.ca/speaking to learn more and schedule your event today. Because greatness starts with inspiration. I have some rapid fire questions if you're up for it. Okay. Favorite book?
No Limits. That's my book.
That's a great one.
Oh my goodness. My favorite book. Any life story, any biography, I love them all. It's so interesting to learn about other people. Yes, definitely.
Yeah, I agree. Favorite food?
I like fruit. I'm a fruitarian.
Three things you take with you to a deserted island.
Three things I would take. I take my dogs with me. Yes. I take my bike with me. Probably my mother.
Oh, nice. That's really sweet. I was hoping you would say your bike. Your bike. And who's a celebrity that you would like to have dinner with, dead or alive?
Honestly, I would just rather have a good dinner with my friends and family. That would impress me more than any. I mean, I'm just not that. I don't dote on anyone. I'm impressed with a lot of people, what people have done and whatever. But to me, friends and family would be, I'd rather spend any day than with somebody I don't know.
I love that answer.
Your
go-to karaoke song?
I love Adele. So anything with Adele is good, right?
Yes. Yes. Oh.
Is it Rolling in the Deep or what is it called? Or what's it called? That's why I can't remember.
Rolling in the Deep?
Rolling in the Deep. Yeah.
Yes. So good.
Yeah.
That's what we've got. Yeah. Whoa. Great song.
Yeah.
So what's coming up next for you? You talked about the race that you're training for. Is there anything else that you have in the works?
Yes, actually. The No Limits documentary is picked up by JRB Entertainment in Los Angeles. So we're just in the point right now of completing the contract with them. So hopefully that will be successful. And then hopefully a new version of the No Limits book as well. So a couple of things going on.
Yeah, that's exciting. That sounds very exciting. And any final thoughts that you'd like to leave the audience with?
No, I mean, just go out there and live life and don't be afraid, right? You know what I mean? Live every day like it's your last.
No limits.
No limits. Exactly.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to put the links for your website, your book, in the show notes. Is there anywhere else you would like people to find you online or to connect with you?
On the website, Facebook, any social media outlet, you'll find me there. Yeah.
Perfect. I'll put them all in the show notes. Great. Make it nice and simple.
Thank you
so much for coming on today. I really appreciate this.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I don't know about you all, but I'm feeling pretty darn inspired from Leah's story. And if you want more of this, definitely pick up her book, No Limits. It's a powerful story of resilience and perseverance. And when you read it, I think you'll be inspired to overcome any of the challenges or obstacles that you might be facing, any of the things that are holding you back from having the life that you truly want. Thank you so much for joining us today. I hope you did enjoy this episode. And if you did, as always, leave that 5-star review. And even more importantly, share this episode with a friend who you think would benefit from hearing this interview. Thank you so much. Have an amazing week, and I'll be back again on Thursday for another episode.